actually said, my name is Katie, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Katie.
I couldn't have said that when I came in these rooms 3 years ago, because I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought I just had a mild drinking problem. And by my third meeting, I knew I was one of y'all. And because you all said what was in my heart and that I didn't have the courage to say, I thought alcoholics were bad people. I thought they were less than. I thought they were morally corrupt. They should be able to use their will to be able to not do that. And now I know that our addictions tell us all kinds of crazy, wrong things, just to keep us down. It's odd that we have a disease that wants to kill us. I don't know if it's just Darwinism, trying to thin out the herd or what, but it really is odd that this happens to us. I don't think this happens in animals. I don't think it happens to insects. I think that we have something that is taken out a portion of the population, and I don't know why, but I've gotten out of the debate. So anyway, I have no idea what else I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm nervous, and I've only given a couple talks before, and I'm not a public speaker, and I'm very, very shy. But I prayed that I would have the words to stand up here and talk for a while, and I brought my backup girlfriend to help give me courage. But along with you, I'm sure I'll think of something to fill the next 50 or so minutes. So what brought me here specifically, well, I think my higher power brought me here. I think my higher power has a very funny sense of humor, and looking back over the years, there was lots of little, I could have probably gotten in here a tad sooner, but it all happened when it should happen, because I have not had to go back out and do any more research from my initial sobriety date. I haven't had a drink since December 7th, 2014, and I'm so grateful that I have not found it necessary to go back out. And I was a maintenance drinker. It's very, I had no hope or concept of what my life would look like without my best friend and companion alcohol. I couldn't see it. I couldn't see what it would look like to live that life, because I was in a miserable marriage. I had a really stressful work life, and had grown up typical, and what everybody says, dysfunctional household, and mine was about par for the course. Not as horrible as some, but bad nonetheless. And it gave me alcohol. When I learned that there was such a thing, I realized that would be another thing that I could hide in, and I would not have to be Katie, and I could be somebody else. I could be funny and outgoing at parties, and do fun things, because I could not do those things otherwise. I was just so shy and insecure and really self-centered, basically. So I will start with what actually brought me here that day, December 8th. December 7th was a Sunday. I'd been out with four of us girlfriends. We have a Christmas tradition that we take each other. We all go out to a really nice restaurant. That's our Christmas gift to one another. And we've been doing it for 20 years. And we get dressed up, and we go someplace that our husbands would normally never take us. Maybe usually went into D.C. or, even then at Little Washington one time. We would really splurge, and that would be our night to look good and show up and just have a big time. And, there's always wine involved. And two of those four are just, they're not alcoholics. They drink like normal people. But the one always drank way more than me, and that's one of the reasons what we had in common and why we were such good friends for so long, because we drank the same. And actually, she drank way more than me, and I tried to keep up with her a lot of times, and finally I learned that that was not physically possible. So, and it was funny because she's a very well-educated, really good job, an attractive woman, but when she drinks, she gets obnoxious. She can't follow a conversation. She's rude, and not attractive anymore. She's a lush, and nobody wants to be around her. And so that evening, we were at a nice restaurant in D.C., and I usually, if I'm driving, I had would monitor my my drinking, and especially if I had my girlfriend's precious cargo in the car with me. I typically did not drink, overdrink. And that night I watched it, and I didn't overdrink. I didn't get the wine pairings with dinner like my friend did. And I didn't have two drinks before dinner like she had. And so by the end of the dinner, you know, and it's a lovely restaurant, we're all looking good, and she'd been totally obnoxious the whole night. And we were repeating stories, and it was really a downer. And we're all, like, just gritting our teeth trying to get through the evening. And when we all went home, I was talking to my one girlfriend that I had driven with, you know, what can we do for Sue? You know, we're so worried about her. She drinks way too much, and I'm feeling like a bit of a hypocrite. And, you know, we realize there's nothing we can do. So anyway, so I go home that night, and I'm thinking, you know, what can I do for my friend Sue? And I, within about 2 minutes of thinking that, I realized, well, why don't you get a hold of your own drinking problem, and then maybe you can help her. And so the only thing I could think of was to go to AA. I'd never been, I don't know anybody that, I had a distant uncle on who married into my family that was had gotten help through AA. But he lived in Canada and had a very different life than me. And he was the only one that I ever knew that had gone to AA, but he raved about it. And he had been sober like 30 years before he died. And he was a raging alcoholic. But he was in recovery for a long, long time and lived a good life afterwards. And I have an uncle on my father's side who drank a lot. But I don't think he ever went to AA. So it doesn't run in my family. It's not. I can't blame it on can't blame that on my parents. So I went to this AA. So I woke up the next morning, and went about my day. And then I thought, shoot, I said I was going to go to that AA meeting today. You know, now I got to do what I said I did was going to do. And I could do it for her. I couldn't do it for myself. You know, it was funny, but. So I Googled a meeting, and there was one nearby. It was in I was living in Haymarket at the time, and there was one in Manassas at noon. And I had to go to Manassas anyway that day for something, and it was like there was no excuse why I couldn't go. So I just mustered up my courage, and because you know I was afraid I'd meet somebody I knew there, and I did, and. I walked in that church, and they had old, overstuffed couches around the perimeter of the room, and a guy sitting next to me, he looks at me, he said, did you come on your own, or did the court send you? And I said, what? He said, did you come on your own, or did the court send you? And I said, trying to translate what he meant. I said, oh, no, I'm here on my own. You know, nobody, of course, you didn't send me because I didn't know that people came to get their paper signed. And no, I'm here on my own. I'm, you know, here for a friend. I'm just here to see what, you know, what's up with this gig. So anyway, it turned out to be a big meeting. And they embraced me. And I told the truth. I said, you know, that I was here about my friend, but I also thought I just had a drinking problem. And they were so non-judgmental. They said, well, just, you know, they told me about just listen and come here, try to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And if you think you're not an alcoholic by the end of that time, you know, it's not for you. And they gave me a big book and a list of phone numbers. And they were, there was a young woman in there that picked up a one-year chip that day. And I was like, oh, my God, how did she do that? In a whole year? And she, like, looked like she was relatively sane. I didn't know how, like, and she was younger than me, and she seemed happy. And then there was another man in the room, and he was an older fella. He hadn't had a drink since he came in there, and that was 29 years. And I thought, you mean you could do that? You just come in there once, and it, like, stuck? Because I thought I was going to go home and tell my husband about my weird day at this, going to an AA meeting, and pour myself a drink and, you know, use that as research and never come back. But I didn't. I thought, well, maybe I could stay sober today. And it was enough of a challenge, you know. I thought, well, like, not ever having a drink again. And, like, that would be like a badge of honor to say I never, like, that this program really works, and that maybe that would be, because I just knew if I let myself slip that time, I would let myself slip other times. And so I just haven't drank every day since then. And I have had incredible changes in my life, and they were, a lot of them were really, really hard, but I've managed to get through them. And I never thought I had the self-confidence or the courage to do that before. I had really bad depression growing up, like mind-numbing depression, and the alcohol really played a really key role in that when I became an adult. It really dovetailed in with that, because it also, depression gives you a place to hide too. And I was a happy little kid. I was born to parents that wanted me and loved me and provided a roof over my head, and I always had enough to eat. I always had a bicycle. I was a little tomboy. I was always climbing trees, and I rode my bike all over the neighborhood. I lived in a time where kids could leave, as long as you came home when the streetlights came on, you were good. And I had a good, happy little life there till about third grade. And I think the weight of the world kind of came down on me, and we moved to a place where we were a little more isolated. And my father, like I say, I know that, you know, they loved us, and I have an older brother. My father he was manic depressive, and he would get violent. There was times where I thought, you know, he might beat one of us to death. He never harmed my mother, but if my brother and I misbehaved some kind of way, like if we invited a friend over for dinner without asking permission, the belt would come out of the steel ruler. It was bad. And I think now, you know, that this kind of thing wouldn't happen in a middle-class society. They would have taken us away from my parents. And my mother, I don't blame her. She just cowered. She didn't have the strength to deal with them either. And she had a bad heart condition. And she was not physically a strong person, but she was spiritually, to me, a lovely person. And she was always my rock. But we always treated Dad like he was an object outside of ourselves that nobody could really handle. And my brother ran away from home when he was 15, and he never came back. And I don't blame him. I see him occasionally, but it really warped his mind. It was absolutely sadistic the way he was beaten when I was a child, and he still suffers from it because he decided to take the hiding route out too. He started smoking pot when he was a very young man, and he's hidden in that his whole life. He doesn't have a whole lot of tangible items. He is married and has a daughter, a grown daughter, and she turned out very well. But he suffers greatly, and he didn't get into a trade, a lucrative career, and he doesn't have really anything. I feel bad for him, but he stays in his basement and he smokes pot every day when he comes home from work, and he'll be working till the day he dies, I'm sure, because he doesn't have any money or any savings or anything really to fall back on. He fakes it. He thinks, I see him, and he'll say he's fine, but I know he's not. But I can't fix him. I don't know if he's got he doesn't have any self-will, but he does. You know, I don't think he's an alcoholic. He might be. He probably does drink too, but I can't help him any more than I can share my experience, strength, and hope with me. And he is happy that I am in recovery. He doesn't know how I haven't revealed my that I am in this program with him, but he knows that I don't drink, and he's happy for me. So anyway, coming up, the depression got really bad, and that's just how I dealt with that. And I think my mother got depressed too, just because she was living with a crazy man. And I developed an eating disorder when I was in seventh grade. And back then, you know, nobody had ever heard of anorexia. And I was hospitalized for about 6 months, maybe longer, maybe the better part of eighth grade. And they just didn't know how to deal with that back then. And to this day, I really don't know how that manifests itself. I was kind of a, I wasn't a fat kid. I think as a tween, I was probably a little chunky, but looking back at pictures, I was a cute little kid. And I don't know why, but it was just another form of self-hatred, looking back. I know, you know, and I would get, and my brother would tease me about, you know, things, and I would take it personally. And I manifested the family's dysfunction, and it was my way of escaping or control or a way out or whatever a little kid can do that doesn't know about alcohol and drugs. And so that's what I did, and I'm sure I almost died. And it wasn't until in a hospital bed, you know, I was probably 68 pounds and just skin and bones. My hair was falling out, and I decided I was going to live. And then I did what it took to live, and I started eating again. And it took a long time to go back to normalcy. And by then, you know, I was always the weird kid. I'm very shy, and I just didn't get all those socialization coming up. You know, it sounds like I'm blaming my dad a lot, but he did have a lot of control in his own way. So I didn't know how my parents didn't know how to be sociable and have friends, and so I grew up. I feel like I was raised in a barn. I just didn't know how to have friends and socialize and be a normal person. So, and just being anorexic in eighth grade, you know, when you're still developing and making friends. And then I went into high school, and I was the weird kid, and it didn't get any better. And I was just so depressed, just mind-numbing depression. And I would, you know, it would go from bad to worse, but I don't remember a lot of my childhood. I'm sure it was just a coping mechanism, but I just was gone. And I just blocked out a lot of things. And I don't really know how I survived, but somehow I did. And anyway, in my senior year of high school, something really good happened. My homeroom teacher, we all have maybe those that teacher that really goes out of their way to help kids, and he helped everybody in our homeroom class. He was great. He would do all kinds of stuff. He'd take us camping and just take us on field trips, and he was a great guy. And he got me into where I went to high school in Chantilly. There was a vocational printing program, and he had put himself through college running a printing press. And so he suggested, because I was doing so horribly in school because I had this mind-numbing depression that I could not focus on anything. I couldn't do homework. I didn't do much. And I did have a job, though. I worked fast food joint, and I enjoyed that. But pretty much other than that, I never did anything school-wise. And it's amazing if you just don't cause too much trouble that you can get by in school. If you don't break any major laws or rules, you can get by. And they'll check your name for attendance, and you don't have to turn in any homework or do anything. And that's what I did. But anyway, I took this vocational printing, and it was I absolutely loved it. It was the first thing that made sense to me. Now I know that I've got really bad ADHD, and now I'd probably be in a special class, and they'd probably put me on medicine. But I can't learn like that. I learned with my hands, and it was a perfect fit for me. And I did really well in that class, and I got Outstanding First Year Printing Student Award that year. And when I graduated, I had a job lined up in the printing field already. And I graduated on a Friday, and I went to work on a Monday and for the federal government, and I stayed employed for 37 years. And I've been retired for 3 years, so I have a good life now. But when I was 17, I was a senior, and I was taking this printing program, and my parents decided to move that winter to Maryland, and we were living in Fairfax, Virginia, and of course I didn't want to go. I was taking this printing thing, and maybe I'd actually get a job, because I didn't get any direction. I see parents now, they go to their kids' soccer games and help their kids write their college admissions essays and stuff like that. I didn't get any of that. I was just alone, and so I didn't go with them when they moved. I had neighbors that offered to take me in, and that's what I did. I lived with some neighbors until I graduated, and then I went to work, and I would live in various places. I would rent people's basements and sleep on couches, and I just kind of got by. I was kind of scrappy, and just did what I had to do. I didn't have a whole lot of guidance, but I didn't have any guidance, but I just did what I could. But I went to work every day. About that time, so I'm graduated, and I wasn't a drinker. I would go to, back then they were called field parties, and people would be grazing hell and drinking beer, but I wasn't a big beer drinker, and I could drink, one or two back then, and when I would start to feel it, I would cut myself off, and well, that's normal. Looking back, it's like, wow, I wish I'd kept that up, but I didn't. When I found hard liquor, that creeps up on you pretty quick, and I'm a pretty cheap drunk, so I remember getting in trouble quite a few times, trying to drinking daiquiris or all those pink squirrels or whatever people do, those sweet drinks, and that you can't taste the alcohol. But I went to work every day. Even if I went into Georgetown and was out, because you could drink in Georgetown when you were 18, and I'd stay out all night long, and I'd still go to work the next morning. So all those things never told me that I would ever have a drinking problem, because I never missed a day of work, and I never got a DWI. I never got in trouble with the law, and so that kept me out there for a long, long time. I got all those not yets. And I guess when I was about 20, I met a man who was very handsome. He was charming, and he was interested in me. And I just thought, this is it. Because I had never really had a serious boyfriend or anybody really to, other than, dating here and there, but no serious boyfriend. And I met him, and his parents were just lovely, fairly well-to-do, very cultured, and they really treated me well, and I met him, and he was just so charming, and I didn't also realize that he was manipulative and narcissistic and punitive, and he was also had a bad temper, and it creeps up on you slowly, and you allow it to happen once or twice. You don't have to be hit every day to reinforce that behavior that reaction to the behavior. You just do what you have to do, and I just think this is almost a story of survival. I did everything I could to try to make that relationship better. What I thought I could. I paid all the bills and I cleaned the house perfectly. And still, a whole lot of times, it wouldn't be good enough. There'd be a spot on the mirror, or maybe I'd get some grass clippings on the driveway. I laughed funny, or I talked to my friends on the phone oddly, or I burned the rice one time. And I lived like that for about 35 years. So it wasn't until I sobered up, I was able to get the courage to leave that relationship. I've had a really good life since recovery. It was hard at first. Like I say, I didn't know how to be or how to act or what to do with all my time. I didn't drink during the day, because that was for alcoholics. People that drank Bloody Marys at breakfast, that's an alcoholic. And I never wanted to put that label on me, because once I identify a problem, I have to feel like I have to deal with it. Whether it's a medical issue or something wrong with my car, if I see my tires low, I'm going to fix it. I didn't ever think that was me, because there's always worse people. There was the passed out drunk, or I always compared out. I'm gonna have to look at my notes here for a minute, because I know I'm forgetting. I'm a little nervous. I was lucky to find a sponsor about 3 weeks in, and it was funny. So coming into AA, I didn't know what those 12 steps were for. And people would talk about doing the steps, doing the steps, doing the steps. And it's like, why are they talking about that? I just thought we were here to try to figure out how to not drink, one day at a time, not take that first drink. And it's not the first drink, it's, first drink that'll get you drunk. And I'm like, no, it's the fifth drink that gets you drunk. The first drink doesn't. But anyway, all those little charming sayings that I didn't believe or understand. And anyway, the 12 steps was like the last thing I was going to do, because it was number 4, number 5 that looked like a lot of introspection, and I did not want to look back on my life because I didn't want to relive any of that horror. I just had some issues that I was not willing to look at. Fortunately, about 10 years ago, I found a type of therapy that was able to pretty much cure my depression. It's a homeopathic type of therapy. It's called Body Talk, and it's a tapping technique. And I found this woman that was I just ran into her. It was a mutual friend, and she was giving a talk on this Body Talk therapy, and I thought it was all woo-woo. She happened to pick me out of the audience to work on, to show how this thing was. And you lay on a table, and she just taps on you, and supposedly you're going to feel better. And I did. And she told me, you know, and I told her about my depression, and she said, you know, that's something that's a real specialty with us. And she thought she could help with it. And so I did. I was so bad. It was so bad between the depression and the alcoholism and the abusive husband but she was able to ameliorate those symptoms the first time. And by the third visit, and she promised me that she wouldn't be dragging up the past and I wouldn't have to revisit all those horrors of childhood. And it worked. She saved my life, because I know beyond a shadow of a doubt I would have taken my life somewhere along in there if it wasn't for her. And I still talk to her. She moved to Florida, and I talked to her on the phone because she is a regular therapist too, and we talk about stuff. And, you know, she said this alcoholism, you know, it just played right into all that, the depression. And so she saved my life, and I always say AA saved my butt. So I got a good sponsor, and the depression was gone. So I was able to do my fifth step with her. Even though I had a sponsor, I had something that was on my mind and on my heart that I just thought, you know, I carried this thing around with me for decades. And I finally broke down and just had to tell her because of this, these steps, you know, walking through these steps, and this is what you're supposed to do. And somehow my sponsor, she was so good. She was just like, she didn't push it on me. We just did it. And she was always talking to me about all her screw ups and how all the things that she did, and now I know she's trying to say, like, you know, we all make mistakes, and we have fortune enough to survive and make it here, and we can help others, and that's what she was doing for me. So I did my fifth step with my old therapist, I walked out of that therapy session. It was like the world had changed. It was a rainy day, and I'm coming out of there, and I'm like looking around. I just didn't know if maybe people wouldn't be out there anymore or something, or maybe, you know, God would have taken away the world or something. It was just weird to have verbalized that thing that I felt was so heavy on my heart. And this happened another way that God's got a sense of humor. So I'm sitting there at the light, and I've just done my fifth step, and it's like, oh my God, now what? And I'm sitting there at the light, and there's a car in front of me, and there, on the bumper sticker was, it said, "Love who you are." I don't know what that was an advertisement for, but I just thought it was a gift from God. It says, "Love who you are." It's like, because I never accepted myself. And here it is, you know, a bumper sticker of a car in front of me. It's like, after I did my fifth step. So I knew that, you know, this stuff is working. And if I'm willing to lay down my defenses long enough, to do what this program tells me to do. I will live a happy, joyous, and free life and live a better life. And so that was about 4 or 5 months into my sobriety. I don't know how my sponsor got me to work those steps, but she did, and I got through it. I mean, like, it was the most monumental thing. And anyway, so I got through that, and meanwhile, you know, my husband, who blamed all of our marriage problems on my drinking, now he's ticked off because he doesn't have anybody to drink with, and I'm always going to those damn meetings. All you do is go to meetings. And but I had to do something in the evenings because that's when I drank. I would usually pour myself a gin and tonic and start making dinner and then open up that bottle of wine and have a glass and then maybe have another glass. And that's how I spent my life. And then he would pour himself a bourbon and watch the television, and I would go upstairs, and we would never have to talk. And we lived like that for a very long time. So in the evenings, I would go to meetings, and I just had to stay busy. And I used all the tools of the program. Like I say, I had a sponsor, and I started hanging out with people. I remember people saying, you know, take these phone numbers and call somebody if you feel like having a, you know, just, and people would be doing stuff together. They'd go out to breakfast and stuff like that. So I'll backtrack and talk about, so my first meeting, I was in Manassas, and they were so kind to me, and I did what they said, and I took the big book home and I read it, and then my third day I went to a women's meeting, and that's when the light came on. Just like I knew I had found my tribe. Everybody was speaking what was in my heart, and we read that one story in the big book where that woman, she wasn't that bad, and she didn't think she was an alcoholic because she drank out of a glass. And I'm saying, yeah, that's me. You know, I didn't drink like Budweiser out of a can. I drank good wine, you know, and I drank top shelf alcohol. And so, you know, the things that we tell ourselves. I hear people that drink like Listerine and Sterno. Oh my God, you know, that drinking Budweiser out of a can to me was along that line. So that was another thing that kept me out for a long, long time. You know, it was just feeding on my insecurities. I've been so blessed since I came into this program. I've been able to say goodbye to my father, and he passed. And we had an estranged relationship, but I put down my weapons because I just decided I wasn't going to carry that around with me for the rest of my life, how he treated me and my brother. And I did tell him at the end that I was sober, and he was happy about that. And about 3 or 4 months into sobriety, my mother-in-law, who I adored, I was actually away, and I got a call that she probably would, that she was dying. And she'd been really sick for a long time, but she was like 90-something, and you just never knew. She had a strong constitution, and I didn't think she was ever really going to go. But I got the call, and I'd been sober about 4 months, and I got the call from my sister-in-law about like 1 o'clock in the morning. And I know if I had been drinking, I would not have acted on it. But I picked up the phone and I called my mother-in-law at the nursing home, and there was somebody there with her because she was dying, and she had pneumonia and her lungs were filling up with fluid, and she had that death rattle, and it was just awful, and she could barely speak. But I was able to tell her that I loved her, and I thanked her for raising my two favorite people, my ex-husband, who I do adore, and his sister, who I'm extremely close to, and I thanked her for taking care of me, because she and her husband kind of were my the parents that I didn't have. They were very generous to me and kind, way kinder than I probably deserved to be. They liked that I was a stable factor in my husband's life because they couldn't handle him either. So I was able to do that, and I was glad looking back that I was able to do that for that and my dad too. Before they left out, because we don't want to carry those things around with us after when people are gone. My mother passed away in 1991, and there's when they're gone, they're gone. So I got sober in December. That following September, my husband says to me one night, you don't seem very happy. I think we should split up. And this was not the first time this was mentioned. But that was my opportunity. And I was sober. And I knew what I wanted at that point. And he said the thing that I'm sure he was not expecting. I said, okay. I didn't start crying and beg for him to take me back and let's work it out and let's go to therapy and let's go to marriage counseling and I'll do whatever you need me to do and I'll do backflips and whatever it is. I just said, okay. And then he got really, really angry. And he told me that I'd be living in a box and I couldn't take anything with me and I'd be living, never find anybody to take care of me the way he did. And but I knew in my heart, I said, well, if I gotta live in a box or sleep on somebody's couch like I did when I was younger, I said, that's what I'll do. I had my retirement, my government retirement, and it wasn't a whole lot, but it was enough. And I guess I'd garnered enough courage from being able to quit drinking that I was able to leave. And so that following November, I was in a meeting in Warrenton, and I'm more worried about where I'm going to live. I didn't know where I was going to be. I didn't know what town I would live in. I was totally adrift. And but I was going to meetings in Warrenton all the time for some reason, because there's a lot of meetings in Warrenton. And one day I was there, and it was I picked up my 11-month chip, and so the guy that was leading the meeting, he asked me to share. Yeah, there they typically ask everybody who's picking up chips that day to share, and I said my name, and I said I was an alcoholic, and I burst into tears. And the guy next to me said, "You okay?" "Yeah, my marriage is falling apart." I was just waterworks. Somebody handed me a box of Kleenex, and then they just carried on the meeting, the rest of the meeting. And nobody was looking at me. And the guy next to me, he was worried, because he wanted to make sure I was all right. It wasn't because I was a total embarrassment to the female gender. And and I left out of that meeting pretty sad and demoralized. And I was headed home towards my home in Haymarket. And for some reason, I went a different way. I went away on the other, drove through the backside of town, and I don't know why, because it's not on the way to my home. But I drove past a set of townhouses that were being built, and there was one left. And it was a sunny day in November. It was cold, though. It was a Sunday, and I called the builder, and it was still under construction. There was just the studs up, and I asked him if I could look at that townhouse that was under construction. He said, "Sure, walk, go ahead." And I said, "Well, there's just one problem." I said, "I'm looking to buy a house." I said, "But I'm not even separated." And I said, "I want to make sure that this house is mine." And he said, "Oh, that's fine. We can write up a contract however you want." I'm thinking, yeah, right, you salespeople say anything. But I went in that house, and I just knew I was home. I just had a glimmer of hope that I could make this happen. I didn't know how I was going to make it happen. But I could feel in my heart that I could be there, and I knew that I could stay sober in Warrenton. I was afraid if I was single that I would end up, you know, going to bars and hanging out and being lonely and relapse. But I knew I could stay sober in Warrenton, and the next day I signed the contract. And the weird thing was that that house had been under contract. It's the nicest house in that development because it faces west and it's an end unit. And other people had wanted that unit, but it was the first one sold, and the woman backed out. So I was able to get it. And it was really meant for me. And I moved in 2 months later. And I live such a good life now. It's incredible the things that we can do in sobriety. Leaving my husband was by far the hardest thing I've ever done. I still strangely love him to pieces. You know, we fall in love with our captors often. You know, it's called the Stockholm Syndrome. And, you know, you can fall in love with an abuser, especially when you meet somebody that young. And we had a lot of good times together, and I have to catch myself, because I often think about drinking in the same fashion. I forget all the bad times, I remember the good times. And my therapist also says that's a coping mechanism. You know, we can't live in that sadness and despair also always, or it would take us down. But I have to remember that. And so that's why I keep coming back here, because y'all are still telling my story every day, and I'm reminded that that I could go back out, and that this happy, joyous, and free life that I live today, and I wake up every morning, and I'm thanking God, because that's who I prayed to. I prayed for God's grace to help me walk through these this life sober. Because I had no idea how I could do it without my friend alcohol, because it gave me something to look forward to. I didn't know that I had the volition. I didn't know I had a choice to live a happy life. I didn't think I deserved it. I didn't know how to make that happen. And it's just by the grace of God and all the miracles that happen in this program. And I think when I'm living on the right path, helping others and loving others, and I think these good things unfold. I think bad things do happen to good people, but and I've had some, you know, like I say, really hard things to go through, but I couldn't have faced any of these with the grace that I have without this program. I want to thank you all for being here, and thank you for asking me to step out of my comfort zone. And being here tonight. Thanks.